This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are some of the headlines today from NPR News. Last week's train bombings in Spain bring fresh attention to Islamist terror groups, their tactics, and their motivation. In a new book, author Ian Baruma traces the historical roots of Islamic extremism and presents it as the latest front in a long, very long war, not a conflict of civilizations, he writes, but a battle of ideas. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're going to be talking about, particularly if you have experience of anti-Western thought, give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN, at npr.org. Ian Baruma is the co-author of Occidentalism, The West in the Eyes of Its Enemies, and he's with us by phone from New York City. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you.
What is it that the idea of the West, that its enemies, like Islamists, hold?
Well, in a nutshell, it is a dehumanizing idea of the West in the sense that the West is a sort of a ruthless machine civilization without a soul, without a spirit. So there's no spiritual dimension. It's efficient and ruthless and rich, of course, powerful even, but lacking in any kind of human or human spirit.
In an article in the New York Review of Books, you write it, describe it as, in no particular order, materialism, liberalism, capitalism, individualism, humanism, rationalism, socialism, decadence, and moral laxity, as opposed to others who see themselves as characteristics as self-sacrifice, discipline, austerity, individual submission to the collective good, worship of divine leadership, and a deep faith of the superiority of instinct over reason.
Correct.
Now, those distinctions are embraced, you argue, not just by Osama bin Laden and Islamists, but by a lot of different and seemingly very disparate groups who have attacked Western ideas and Western thought.
Yes, I think at least in European history, you can see it ever since the Enlightenment that, of course, extolled reason and individual liberties and so on and so forth. And especially when that kind of thing was enforced by French armies when they conquered Europe under Napoleon, it unleashed a reaction against them which extolled the opposite of the virtues of blood and soil and the spirit of the native people and so on. Now, that doesn't mean that all criticism of rationalism or even individualism is in itself murderous or leads to Nazis or Islamist extremists. Of course not. I mean, there are many legitimate reasons to be skeptical about the claims of rationalism. But it can become murderous. And we argue that the ideas of Islamic extremism, some of them come from Islam and the Middle East, but some of them were borrowed from Europe itself.
Though a lot of people would find it hard to make comparisons between the ideas of Osama bin Laden and you write a lot about the Japanese militarists before the Second World War.
Well, one of the things that keeps on cropping up in all enemies of liberalism or the kind of liberalism commonly associated with the West is the idea of the love of death. We love death, you love life. Or as one Taliban activist said to, I think, an American reporter in the war in Afghanistan, you'll never win because American soldiers love Coca-Cola and we love death. This is exactly what Nazi philosophers used to say, and it was, of course, what was behind the kamikaze attacks in World War II in Japan. It's a sort of self-sacrifice taken to a kind of cultish level that these groups, on the whole, have in common.
Now, you go back in history in terms of a lot of these values, but you go very far back in terms of the idea of this as a sort of urban-rural divide, the idea of the city going as far back as Babylon.
Yes, I mean, Babylon was, of course, seen in the eyes of its enemies as wicked and decadent and so on, but particularly it was seen as a symbol of human beings striving to do what really should have been the province of God. And building the tower was a sort of challenge to God. So those who saw salvation in religious purity and, of course, saw this as a sort of form of human hubris, which, again, is something that keeps on coming back in history regardless of culture or religion. And when purist zealots attack liberalism, forms of freedom, individual freedom, and that kind of thing, they tend to take on similar forms.
And one of the things you write about this is the symbol of the Manhattan skyline as almost a provocation. It appears it's almost omnipresent everywhere in the world. You can't escape it. And, of course, it was a target on September the 11th.
And a kind of modern Tower of Babel. It was these were towers containing people of many languages dedicated to making money. And it was not only a symbol of America and American capitalism, it was very much seen, I think, as a symbol of everything that its enemies loathe about the West.
Another symbol, of course, feminism, a target of Osama bin Laden for sure, but of many of these other groups as well?
Yes, I think to a religious extremist, and you don't have to be an Islamist, although Islamists use this language today and are particularly hostile, but you find it in many fundamentalist religions, of course, but is that women who are free, especially who are free to choose their sexual partners and are as free as men, are seen as harlots. They're seen as prostitutes, and their men are seen as pimps. And when this becomes very extreme, because the whole Western culture and indeed the culture of capitalism is seen as one of pimps and harlots.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation, 800-989-8255, and email us, totn@npr.org. Linda joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. I wanted to raise a couple of questions for Ian Buruma. One, obviously, is the issue of positioning Occidentalism against the idea of Orientalism. I'm sure that he probably has some comments to make on that, and I'll just listen to what he has to say about that. But also I wanted to raise some questions about making the comparison between, say, Islamists manifested today and the pre-war Japanese militarists. You know, I'm a little bit concerned about making these sort of broad general comparisons, especially across time. So I'll just take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Linda. And, of course, the first question about Orientalism, yes. The famous book by Edward Said about the philosophical underpinnings of colonialism.
But yes, our intention was not to attack Edward Said. It was more to show that if Edward Said had one important insight, which was that in Orientalism, non-Western people are dehumanized, they're portrayed as sort of childlike, they're not fully adult. They're voluptuous and all that kind of stuff.
The coolie feels no pain.
Exactly. And whereas we're showing really that there is another side to this, a flip side, if you like, of an equally dehumanizing view of the West as being also something that feels no pain and is less than human, but it's the opposite of the sort of the childlike voluptuary. It's the sort of efficient, ruthless, machine-like, parasitical materialist. And on the second question, I think it's a very good question because, of course, there are many, many things that modern Islamists do not have in common with Japanese militarists of the 1930s. I wouldn't say that they're the same. They come from different circumstances and so on. But what the reason for making these comparisons or to show what they have in common is to show that there is nothing unique about and certainly nothing uniquely Islamic or Arab about Islamic extremism or Islamist extremism, but that they actually have much in common and that, indeed, a lot of their ideas, I mean, these are modern ideologies. This kind of revolutionary Islam is fairly new. And a lot of the ideas taken up by their ideologues, and the same goes for the Ba'athists of Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist party, come from Europe. They were taken from German ideologues in the 1930s and so on. And so these things are related and there are links, and one can draw these links without saying that they're exactly the same.
We're speaking with Ian Buruma, a professor at Bard College and co-author of Occidentalism, the West in the Eyes of Its Enemies. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And another caller on the line is Larry, who's with us from Murray, Kentucky.
Yes, I was wondering if the author feels that there's some element, of course it would be hard to define it as anti-Westernism, but amongst, conservative religious fundamentalists in the United States, the so-called traditional religious right, middle class, generally Caucasian conservatives, but they seem to have a very anti liberal, anti-rationalist, anti-materialist bias, you know, almost to the point of what he was talking about of you know, being in love with death and the afterlife rather than this world. And also being, you know, violently, especially like the anti-abortion violence and anti-gay violence that some people in the radical extremes of that fringe may take it to. And I'll take my answer off here. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Larry.
Yes, I would agree with Larry. I think that Christian extremism of that kind is very similar. The people who see the world in terms of good and evil, and everything is evil that does not fit into their sort of purist view of a religious universe, and therefore has to be destroyed in one way or another, is just as hostile to liberalism and the kind of idea of the liberalism that is associated with the West as the Islamist extremists. And that's why I stress these ideas are not unique to the Middle East or the East or anything like that. They're right here in the West itself. It's where a lot of these ideas came from, and it's where some of these ideas still linger.
Here's an email from Ryan in Minneapolis. I don't think it's fair to lump all fundamentalist or zealous conservatives together. Having been a member of the conservative evangelical movement all my life, I have never heard an advocation of violence or death in order to fight against the ideas we oppose. I think each individual conservative movement is unique to itself and cannot be so easily generalized with the others.
It is true that you cannot generalize so easily, and it's also true that not every fundamentalist group is going to be murderous, and I certainly don't think that they all. We would only speak about Occidentalists, or it only becomes murderous when it's linked to political power and it has a program of mass murder or extermination. Of course, not every religious fundamentalist or religiously conservative group has that in mind. All I'm saying is that there are deep-seated anti-liberal, anti-individualist ideas that many of these groups have in common, and they sort of fertilize one another. They don't all become murderous, and which is a good thing, too.
And not all of them become, you know, take over countries as Hitler did. And given that, I mean, how pervasive do you think Islamism, as you're talking about it, is within the larger Islamic world?
Well, this is the big question, of course. So far, they haven't taken over any countries. They did for a while in Afghanistan, and I was in favor of the war in Afghanistan. I think it was a good thing to do, but the program of Al Qaeda and related groups, of course, is to take over countries. Now, whether they'll succeed or not, I don't know. But that's definitely, they are a revolutionary movement, and they seek to take over first Muslim countries and ultimately, of course, in their dreams, the world. And now that's highly unlikely, but it's definitely what they want. Mm-hmm. It would be better for the world if they didn't succeed.
Let's go now to Rodney, and he's in Tallahassee, Florida.
How you doing?
Okay.
All right. Actually, my question was, I'm a African-American student at Florida A&M, and obviously I'm a minority in the United States. What I've seen, though, is that this war on Iraq and this quasi-war on Islam has been portrayed as a war on good and evil, which is what I suppose you're speaking of, and that anything that's not in our rationale is inherently evil. And you sell that to people. But my question is that how effective has, in the past or in the present, have we been on combating ideas? Because the war on crime, the war on terrorism.
I hear your question, Rodney, and I'm cutting you off because we just have a few seconds left, and I want to give Ian Baruma a chance to answer. It's a good question.
I think the war on ideas cannot really be won by, certainly not by force alone. And I think going to war is should be a last resort, and I think going to war in Iraq has probably not been the most effective way to fight the kind of hostility that I'm talking about. So I would agree that that fighting military wars against evil are something of the last resort and should not be undertaken lightly.
In his article, Ian Baruma concludes it by writing, accountants mulling over shady bank accounts and undercover agents bribing their way will be more successful in the long-term struggle than special macho units blasting their way into caves in Afghanistan. Rodney, thank you. A very good question. And Ian Baruma, we thank you for your time today. Very
thank
interesting.
You.
Ian Baruma is a professor at Bard College and co-author of Occidentalism, The West in the Eyes of Its Enemies. Lynn Neary is here tomorrow. I'll be back Monday. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.